You're listening to The Mincing Rascals. The date is Wednesday, June 29th. The time, 2:35 in the afternoon. I am not John Williams. I'm John Hansen. Been filling in for John Williams on WGN Radio. You can also catch me Monday to Thursday at 6 p.m. for Your Money Matters. And on Saturdays, Let's Get Legal at 1 p.m.
Hey, what's up, y'all? I'm Brandon Pope with WCIU's On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the utterly unsurprised editor of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter, which this week on Thursday will feature a lengthy profile of mincing rascal John Williams. We're going to publish this while he's out of the country, so he can't sue me.
That's a great call.
I do have, by the way, online there are profiles of everyone in this podcast. Then they meet the rascals interviews with all of you. So
I think this is my first time on the podcast since you published that interview with me. So I boycotted for some time, but here I am. By the way, you said you're utterly unsurprised. I don't know which story to talk about or that you're unsurprised about. Election results, the January 6th commission, R. Kelly's sentencing. What are you utterly unsurprised about?
I'm all those, but I'm really unsurprised about the election results, that they seem very predictable in a way. I didn't offer any real predictions this time around because I just didn't really.
Which makes it very easy after the fact to say that they were unsurprising when you didn't put any stakes down.
The one that I missed, honestly, I thought that Alderman Villegas was going to do much better. I thought he was going to win the third congressional district race, and he got clobbered. Mm-hmm. And that's really the only result that surprised me. I'll put it around the tables. Are there any other results that I guess the margin of victory for Darren Bailey was also kind of a surprise, but the fact that he won was not a surprise. Anybody got any surprises from Tuesday?
Margin of victory for Bailey, I think, is absolutely the big one for me. I think most people expected him to win, but last I checked, he was up 42 points over Jesse Sullivan, and then Richard Irvin coming slightly behind him. That was actually another surprise. Jesse Sullivan squeaking out second place, albeit a distant second place, over a guy with $50 million in his bank account. Was pretty extraordinary.
It seemed to me that all the undecideds broke for Bailey. There was certainly momentum behind his campaign, and there was very little confidence in the other campaigns in the following weeks, and I think people kind of went with where the momentum was going. Heather Sharon, is there anything we know today that we didn't know yesterday?
Well, I think that we can now say for certain that there is no path to statewide office in Illinois as a Republican unless you full-throatedly embrace former President Donald Trump. And that has been the crucial question of this GOP primary for me, because I think it's important to note that not only did Richard Irvin lose and lose badly, all of the other candidates who took money from Ken Griffin down the line also lost. And the only candidates that Ken Griffin supported and that are going on to the general election were unopposed in that GOP primary. So that is, I think, a stunning repudiation of what some people have suggested to me is my sort of cynicism over the fact that there is a different path in the GOP, a non-Trump path in the GOP. And I think all you have to do is cast a cursory glance at these results to show, in addition to Mary Miller's victory over Rodney Davis in the 15th congressional district, to say that if you are a Republican and you do not support Donald Trump and all that entails, you have no place right now in the Illinois GOP. And I think that is the ground that will be fought in the general election.
I do want to expand on the governor's race and as we pivot to the general in just one moment, but I want to table it for a second just to get Pope in here, because you and I, Pope, have been talking about the first congressional race for a while and the results also of another race that we thought that you thought might be close, and it turned out it was.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Jackson, he in Illinois first, he's, you know, declared victory, is probably going to be the end up being the winner when all the votes are counted. I was surprised, not so much that he won. I was surprised at the placement of votes. I was surprised that Pat Dow finished second. And then you had Swain, I think, all the way down at fifth or sixth,
right,
with about 3% of the vote. That to me I did not see that part coming. I thought Swain was going to finish a lot stronger. I thought Jamal Cole was going to finish a lot stronger. Seeing Pat Dow second there was pretty interesting to me. But Jonathan Jackson, that was no big surprise. I think most of the surprises I saw were the margins, right? Caston beating beating Newman. Saw that coming, didn't see it being a blowout. Like, that was a blowout.
Although you did tell me that you predicted a close race with Danny Davis.
But Danny Davis, Keena Collins won. That one, I think, if you want to talk about key takeaways from this election, I think the key takeaway there is that the Justice Democrats are coming. They still have momentum. Keena Collins outraised Danny Davis. Her ground game was pretty good. But you just had a low voter turnout election, and I think that really was the difference here. Usually favors the incumbent, but Danny Davis, who was a stalwart of the West Side of Chicago, there are a little bit of cracks now in that establishment, and so I think other Justice Democrats and people from that lane are going to be able to look at those results of Keena Collins and say there's a lane in the future to challenge some of these older incumbents.
All right.
So I'll just correct you slightly, Brandon.
Heather, here we go with Jonathan, the facts that we have.
Jonathan Swain finished seventh, and he got
seventh.
And I mean, Brandon said fifth or sixth. Seventh was next in that line.
And he won 3.3% of the vote. And I'm tipping my own hand here a little bit. Sorry, WTTW. But I think that it is instructive to look at what all of the candidates who won or came close to winning had in common. And that's that they were backed by the progressive organizations in Chicago and across Cook County. So you have somebody like Keena Collins, who gave Danny Davis a scare, being supported, as Brandon said, with Justice Democrats. But Delia Ramirez didn't just win in the third district. She demolished Gil Villegas. And that was a race that was explicitly fought on the ground of whether Delia Ramirez should be a congressperson after endorsing calls to defund the Chicago Police Department. And I am fascinated that was the central issue in that race. And she won going away from the very first vote that was cast. And I think that you can make the same argument in a lot of other ballot races. All but one of the state house candidates endorsed by United Working Families, which is very close to the Chicago Teachers Union, won their races, and the one remaining race is maybe a little bit too close to call. So that's a pretty significant record in an off-year election where you had to not only get your people to vote for your candidate, but you had to remind them that they got to go to the polls in the middle of June and at a weird time, and everything else going on, the pandemic and everything else. So I don't know that Bailey's win was surprising, but I think pretty much everything after Bailey's win was in some ways very significant. That's going to have, I think, a really interesting impact on who ultimately decides to run for mayor of Chicago and who runs for the city council and how they run for the city council.
I've got a couple of questions for Heather. One is, how does Jonathan Jackson figure into your calculus here? He did win that race by 9 points.
Sure.
And the latest results I've seen here, out of 17 candidates. So that's a pretty substantial victory. Is he seen as a progressive candidate, really?
Or? He had the support of not only the Chicago Teachers Union, but he campaigned with the support of the Chicago Teachers Union. His mailers identified him as the CTU's chosen candidate in that race. And he had the support of Bernie Sanders. And if you had told me 6 months, a year ago, 2 years ago, that was going to be the deciding factor in a race to replace Bobby Rush, I would have said, maybe, maybe not. But that's a significant amount of progressive energy over somebody like Pat Dow, who has a really fine track record as somebody who gets things done at the city council, but didn't come close to sort of capturing the zeitgeist of sort of being backed by the teachers union and being seen as progressive. And I think that's going to have a big impact, in the mayor's race, where we have the bulk of candidates challenging Lightfoot right now are coming from the right in a, I'm going to be tougher on crime than she is. And there are really only two candidates who are saying, I'm the progressive choice in this race. And I think people, you know, might recover from staying up all night last night and take a look at these results and maybe reconsider some of their life choices.
Do you think that Pat Dowell has an appetite to run? Alderman Dowell has an appetite to run again? I mean, she was running for statewide office, then she shifted over to run for the House district. And people have talked about her as a potential mayoral candidate, as well as some of these other people who lost. Do you have any guesses on that?
So it'd be really tough for Pat Dowell to run against Lori Lightfoot, because she has been sort of hand in glove with her on the budget and other issues. And it would be really difficult, I think, for Pat Dowell to make an argument that somehow she would be better at implementing Lori Lightfoot's agenda than Lori Lightfoot has been. Mm-hmm. So there's just not a lot of daylight between the two of them. Although, caveat, Pat Dowell was one of the several aldermen who voted to roll back the speed camera fines that Lori Lightfoot has championed. And Pat Dowell was in that list of aldermen that Lori Lightfoot said, hey, remember their names.
Right.
Now, here's what I know about Pat Dowell, is that she does not suffer insults. And there could be no greater insult saying, hey, essentially vote against these people next time you see their name. So I don't know how that's all going to play out.
Right.
But
I got to get Austin Berg into this conversation a little bit. He's been sitting back. And I do want to go back to this governor's race, because I think that's these congressional races are fascinating. But Austin Berg, can Darren Bailey win? Two, does he have to pivot to win? Does he have a pivot in him?
Does he have a pivot in him? If you're asking about my uncles in the Effingham area, if they have a pivot in them for their, you know, a political campaign, I'd say, no, they do not. But Darren Bailey is not my uncles, but he just talks like they do. So maybe he does have a pivot in him. It's definitely going to be a massive uphill battle for him against Pritzker. Pritzker's favorables are by no means top of the heap for Democratic governors right. across the state of Illinois. Most of the time you see him below 50%. But you saw in his victory speech over his opponent that he beat by maybe 90 points the last time I checked. But it was really a campaign kickoff for his general election campaign. His first line was, I'm J.B. Pritzker, and I'm going to beat Donald Trump's candidate for governor, Darren Bailey. And the first thing I thought of was, I don't know if you are on the left in Illinois and you complain at all about someone platforming someone who is pro-Trump or platforming someone with views that you disagree with or are disgusted by. J.B. Pritzker just platformed Darren Bailey into the biggest platform you can have as a Republican running statewide, which is to run for governor as the Republican nominee, dump $35 million into that campaign, both promoting Darren Bailey as a conservative and tearing down Richard Ervin as a moderate. And I do think there is something to be said. Of course, Trump played a role in Illinois Republican races this cycle. But you also look at, I think the largest margin for a statewide candidate was the Dan Brady versus John Millhiser Secretary of State race, for example. I think Brady was up like more than 50 points. I don't know if Trump came up at all during that race. And Millhiser has a record in the Trump administration. He was a prosecutor in the Central District of Illinois. So and Brady won by 50 points there. So I think there's something to be said for competently run campaigns also. And I think when you look at sort of the Ervin postmortem, of course, it's not necessarily that there's not a non-Trump or ambivalent or neutral about Trump path to winning statewide, but it's that you can't actively kind of thumb your nose or think you can get by the conservative base or trick them into thinking that one of the most pro-Trump Republicans in the state is a Democrat, as they tried to do over and over again.
Well, also, he didn't answer any questions, I felt like, right? I mean, and John and Pete have talked about trying to, you know, get it's hard to get him online on anything. And even after Roe Wade came out, he couldn't find a position on that. And I think there is something to be said for people respect someone they disagree with as long as they give them an answer. At least you know where someone stands in it. Brandon, do you think that his wishy-washy, you know, dodging of questions was just seen as unattractive to voters?
Absolutely, especially when you pair that with the fact that his positions have flip-flopped. He was a man who voted for Obama, who, by all intents and purposes, seemed like a moderate Democrat, and now he flipped the script. One minute he's Black Lives Matter, now he's saying all lives matter. It became a source of memes and jokes among people. So if anything, I'm not surprised by that result at all, because he just really couldn't identify who he was as a candidate in a GOP race.
Maybe it's impossible, Eric. Right? Maybe there's no, like, in this current political climate, there's just no way to thread that needle.
Well, I think that if he had been more forthright about his views, he would have been able to win a statewide election in maybe 1998 or something. But that's not the Republican Party we have in Illinois anymore. I do think that his slipperiness, his weasel quality, whatever you want to call it, probably hurt him some, but you can't look at this margin of victory and say, gee, if only he had come clean on this, or if only he had, you know, not voted for Obama, or if only whatever, all the little things, TTW exposed some interesting things about him, but none of those seem to matter. Trump's endorsement didn't matter. None of it. I mean, that was an amazing butt kicking that Bailey gave to him. I think that Trump came along and saw where this election was going and just sort of got out in front of the train and was pretending to lead it. But I do think that it was smart of Pritzker. It is smart of Pritzker to platform Trump, however, or Bailey, whatever, however you want to say it, is that if you got to remember that Trump lost Illinois, I think, by 17 points in both of the last presidential elections. This is not really friendly Trump country. It's probably a little more friendly to Trump now than it was 3 years ago or 2 years ago. But I think that's a very smart campaign for Pritzker to link Bailey right to Trump. And Trump's reputation, we'll probably touch on this a little later, is continuing to dwindle with a lot of his revelations about him in the January 6th hearing, that he is losing, I think, some of his steam, his reputation, his political power. So I don't see Pritzker losing this race. I can't begin to handicap some of the races down ballot. I don't know what mood the public is going to be in.
Yeah.
They might say, you know, I'll vote for Pritzker, but I want a Republican Attorney General, or I want a Republican Secretary of State. I want more balance in my state government.
Yeah, I think there's sometimes this rising tide lifts all ships mentality, but I think a lot of people do like splitting their ballots because they feel like it's a check on themselves in some ways. Maybe I'm wrong there, because I don't know if Pritzker can actually be a boom to maybe congressional candidates that might be more in a toss-up district. All right, so whoever wants to, percentage chance, 0 to 100, that Darren Bailey is the next governor of Illinois. You don't have to if you don't want to, but I'll start with Brandon Pope because he's laughing at me. Come on, give it to us.
Percentage chance.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to, it'd be a great prop bet if you had like a DraftKings or FanDuel or something. it'd be great.
I'm sure there are betting markets for that, but we'll put it here, Brandon. Give it to me the number. Come on.
I'm sure there are. I'm going to say 2%.
Wow. Zorn?
I'll go with 5. You never know what happens in the news.
Okay.
I'll say 5.
Austin?
Yeah, I'd say 5. 5 to 10.
All right. Heather, I don't know if you want to do that. You're such a – yeah, I didn't think so. I'm going to go.
Sorry.
I didn't think so. Okay. All right. Well, let's pivot to January 6th commission. Okay. Can we do that, guys? Because I know that – Austin's burying his head down. I don't know.
That wasn't a bury head. That was not a reaction.
Okay.
My phone buzzed.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Because I am fascinated by – I think it was like you had – the testimony on Tuesday, the salacious details that are coming out from Hutchinson, the aide to the chief of staff, about the what happened or didn't happen now, as it turns out, maybe in the sedan or the limo, whatever car he was driving in. I don't think it was the Beast. I think she said the Beast, but it was actually in the different vehicle, about him grabbing an agent or by the clavicle and the steering wheel. But it was a lot of other stuff about the president, former president, knowing about weapons and saying, who cares? They're not here to hurt me. Knowingly sending people to the Capitol or urging them to go, knowing that some of them had weapons, some potential witness tampering stuff. But this little back and forth about whether the testimony was correct about what happened inside the car, right? Was it actually – did he actually lunge for the wheel? That's kind of eating up the news cycle today a little bit. She wasn't saying she saw it firsthand. She was saying she admitted it was, you know, secondhand. but the person was in the room when she heard this and he didn't refute it. Anyways, has that kind of like dummied down or kind of spoiled what was otherwise a really significant day? Heather, you're shaking your head. You think that it still lands?
So I'll just point out that I think the New York Times had really good coverage of sort of the reaction of Trump supporters to Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony yesterday. And this is straight out of their playbook that we've seen since 2016, where people will have made allegations against the now former president. And they have sort of picked at one particular non-germane part of their testimony or their statement and used that to undermine the rest. So the fact of the matter is that the Secret Service does not dispute her testimony that the former president wanted to go to the Capitol and told his Secret Service agents to take him to the Capitol. What they dispute, although they have not done so under oath, and I think that's an important distinction here, has said that they do not believe that have said through anonymous sources that the former president did not reach and grab the steering wheel or grab for the Secret Service agents' shoulders. The other thing I want to point out about this that's driving me a little bit batty is that the Secret Service agents in question have been reported to be significant political supporters of Donald Trump and took political positions in his organization and should not in any sort of stretch of reasonableness be considered disinterested sources on this matter. And I think that's good really point. Key. Also, you know, I just want to sort of, you know, stop for a moment and think that this is a 25-year-old woman. This is essentially her first job out of college. And she got up in front of God, the country, and everybody she's ever met and everybody her mama has ever met and told the truth about the former president in ways that men with advanced degrees from every Ivy League college in this nation have yet to do so. And nobody has disputed what she said under oath. And there's a significant amount of information that we have under oath and obtained evidence for that supports absolutely everything that she said. So you can miss me with sort of questions about sort of the specifics about this. And I would just point out that she said very clearly that this is what she was told. And she was very clear that she did not purport to witness this, but that she was told this. And right. I think these are both really important distinctions.
Yeah, she wasn't claiming she saw it. Although I do really want to know if this is true. What was the president going to do when he got a hold of the steering wheel? Like what, lunge himself up? And I mean, I'm just trying to think of the logistics. I'm not trying to make light of it but I guess I am sort of. Like, what's step two, Mr. President? I don't know.
Well, so that's sort of the problem. Even if people are to make the argument that this person isn't credible, right? If the Hutchinson testimony, like, you know, she has no idea what she's talking about. This is all hearsay, blah, blah, blah. It's very hard to come for somebody to make the argument that, oh, but this doesn't sound like the president. You know, like it's not like he threw a plate at the wall. Are you serious? He acted like a child in an SUV and tried to turn it toward the Capitol. I think that's sort of the problem here. And obviously, this isn't a legal process. The committee doesn't have to make a referral to the Justice Department. And this might not meet the Brandenburg definition of incitement, but it's really not necessarily about that. It's about sort of establishing a record of what happened.
Is it changing anyone's minds? Eric, do you think anyone is watching this? And look, I know people say it's not changing enough minds, but really, I mean, if you're really talking about trying to present this as I know they're not trying to do this as a political thing, but there are the realities of politics. I mean, it doesn't have to move the needle all that much to make a significant difference in national politics, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think you can say that if you move the needle 2 or 3 percentage points with people who are in the middle, who are maybe favorably disposed toward Republican policy positions, but are very uncomfortable and increasingly uncomfortable with the idea of a second term for President Trump, for former President Trump, that you can... You can see that starting to shift. And I think last week on the Rascals, we talked about this poll in New Hampshire that showed Ron DeSantis. It was sort of an outlier poll, but it showed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis edging ahead of Trump in a political preference poll among Republican voters out there. So there is a chance that this is going to just have Republicans say, yeah, I still believe. And you hear this a lot from Republicans who are not all the way over on the right, which is like, I like what Donald Trump did for the country. I like the Supreme Court justices. I like some of his policies, most of his policies. I just didn't like him. That sentiment, I think, is going to really rise a lot more. Now, to get back to the hearings, yeah, I mean, it's possible, I guess, that Cassidy Hutchinson was misremembered something or whatever,
or was lied to, and she's just relaying that information.
But there's every opportunity for people who were there to testify under oath. There's all kinds of people who are refusing to testify under oath. I guess I just heard today that Ginny Thomas says she's not going to testify to the committee. That there are all sorts of people who, if they want to gainsay what she said, what Cassidy Hutchinson said, if they want to do that, they have every opportunity to raise their right hands and sit there like she did and give their version of events. And the fact that they're not, I think, is very telling to me.
Pope?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because, like, we are fascinated by this. I think that her testimony was very compelling. I really don't think people care. And I think part of the reason is because what's going to come of it? That's the big question at the end of this. It doesn't seem like anything will. It feels like Trump has been Teflon for so many years. He's done so many things.
I mean, he lost the 2020 election by 5 million votes and a bunch of
electoral. But his movement is still alive and well, especially here in Illinois. Like, his influence is still heavy on the party. His decision making, everything he's done. I mean, when he was running for office in 2015, there were things he did that should have been red flags automatically. You're not qualified for office. And nothing stuck. So people are just waiting to see, like, will anything stick here? And honestly, there's not a lot of confidence that's been inspired in any of our institutions or any of our lawmakers to say, yeah, something will happen here. So, yeah. You know, I think that's the overall sentiment people are seeing. This is captivating testimony. I think these details are pointing to a real trend that Donald Trump knew what he was doing, that Donald Trump was aware. I think the comment she made about the fact that he was saying he didn't want the things that detect guns or weapons to be there.
The mags.
He thought it was, yeah, the mags. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, it's okay if they have guns. They're not coming for me. Like, things like that. I mean, that's so clear. I just, yeah. What's going to happen from it? I'm not sure anything will.
So zero to 100. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
So I would just say that, you know, there was a lot of sort of gasp inducing testimony yesterday. And I think it's really easy to sort of to get caught up in the ketchup on the wall of it all and to miss the part that Brandon just said, which is that to prove that the former president is criminally liable for what happened on January 6th, one of the questions that's facing in the Department of Justice is whether he's guilty of incitement. And the legal standard of incitement means that he had to have known or reasonably suspected that his words, where he says, go on and let's march to the Capitol, we have to fight or we won't have a country anymore, could have incited violence. And the fact that there are it appears to be under oath testimony that he knew that the crowd was armed, that the administration knew the crowd was armed, and they still allowed, and he still encouraged them to march, and in fact took steps to join them, I think is probably more legally significant than anything else we heard yesterday, with the exception of the allegations that we heard at the very end of witness tampering. Now, you know, Liz Cheney knows how this game is played, and she did not sort of drop those, you know, that warning of witness tampering without sort of fully knowing what she was doing. And I think that that's another area of potential legal exposure for the president. However, we should not underestimate what a shock it would be to our system to have, you know, a former president charged with crimes. And that, I think, is just sort of the largest sort of hurdle that the Department of Justice is facing right now. But every time they hold one of these hearings and they lay out point by point by point the evidence against the former president, it gets a little bit harder for the Department of Justice to sort of come down on the we're not going to prosecute because it would be a shock to the system, I think.
Pete just handed me a statement on behalf of the lawyers for Cassidy Hutchinson. Ms. Hutchinson stands by all of the testimony she provided yesterday under oath to the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Pretty perfunctory, but she's not changing her story. Eric, you mentioned Ginny Thomas. And that brings us to, I don't know where I land on this. Mayor Lightfoot at an event, Pride of the Park, I believe, I imagine it was. Someone had an F. Clarence Thomas shirt on. It didn't say F. It said the whole thing. And then she had a video where she said it, I think, and kind of reeled it up. And people are really were really heated about it. Like, I know this has kind of been hashed out by some people, but like I'm split between like, yeah, that's not the role of an elected official. That is not good language to use, or you shouldn't be promoting that. But like I drive by anywhere and I see F. Joe Biden signs everywhere, and people say, let's go Brandon, which means F. Joe Biden. It just isn't that. Mm-hmm. And politicians say, let's go Brandon, right? So should she rise above? Is it okay that she's in the muck with this stuff? I don't know. Did this offend anyone? Eric, I'll start with you.
Well, I was personally not offended by it. It seemed unwise to me, since it plays into what is considered to be her weakness, which is that she is hyper temperamental and sort of unsuited to the kind of governing style that gets things done. And so to say something like that, although, you know, I certainly understand why she said it, and let's not lose sight of how horrifying Justice Thomas's concurrence was in Dobbs. I mean, that he was basically saying, hey, we're coming for your gay marriages, and we're coming for your contraceptive rights next, you know, so look out, folks. I certainly understand the feeling behind it, and I think I'm split like you, John. I feel like, yeah, I understand why she said it, and I would be lying if I said I didn't have similar thoughts, but that when you are the mayor of a city, you need to probably measure your words a little bit more carefully and come up with perhaps some more constructive things to say in terms of what we can do next and what we're going to do next.
Can I pull the curtain and like show a little bit of what it's like to be a beat reporter covering somebody like Lori Lightfoot?
Do it. Pull that curtain, baby.
So, you know, all the way back in June of 2020, the mayor got up in front of a bunch of cameras and said, I have a message for President Trump, and it starts with F and it ends with you. And if anybody was surprised that she was going to use that kind of language to Clarence Thomas, who, let's just, you know, remind people, have said that he believes the decision legalizing same-sex marriage in America was wrong and should be overturned. And of course, Lori Lightfoot is a lesbian, and she has a kid and she's married. I was like, yes, of course she said this. Like, she has said this before. She will say it again. This is her stock in trade. And beyond it being sort of, I think, a very sort of authentic to who she is, I think that she thinks this sort of language and this sort of direct and vehement response to these sort of attacks, it works for her. She believes it benefits her politically. And she will tell you, as she has told me on many a different occasion, that she believes the criticism that she gets on topics like this is because she's a Black gay woman. And, you know, people can debate that and not debate that, but there's no doubt that she is truly, truly furious at Clarence Thomas, and that she is not one to dissemble or attempt to communicate that in a way that sort of we would consider within the bounds of civility, which she would again argue is a whole notion used to oppress Black people, Latino people, women, and gay people.
Was that her texting you, by the way, Heather, on your phone? Yeah. Saying F, one letter at a time.
Okay. It kind of reminds me, it's the same political calculus of J.B. Pritzker spending $35 million to say that he's running against Trump's candidate for governor. And it's the more that Lori Lightfoot can paint herself as someone who national Republicans are attacking, the better her chances are in spring of next year to run as mayor. And I think in both cases, it's sort of used as a distraction from the governance failures of both of those leaders. And you can run against the most unpopular person possible in Chicago, you know, politically, which is Donald Trump. So I think any attention that she gets for this, especially from the right, is only to her benefit.
I got to say, my wife's reaction was, Well, I guess I got to vote for her now.
Oh, wow.
That's my thing. The days of decorum are dead. They've been dead.
Yeah, but do they have to be like that? That's where I ultimately landed. Was I hated it. I didn't like it. I want our leaders to go one step at a time. And yes, it's not fair because both sides. I hate both sides and things. But the decorum is gone. But someone's got to take a step back towards decorum, and why not her first?
But what does it get you? Like at this point, people are angry. She's showing passion, unlike the president of the United States. And I think at this rate, people want to see that in their elected leaders. They want to see passion. They want to see fire. So she's leaning into that firebrand in a sense that she has. She's making a calculation that maybe this works for her. Maybe there's people that like this about her. But also, I mean, she's from a community that's directly impacted by this. And I think it's fair for her to be
not just a community, but her family is at risk.
Yeah,
right?
The whole entire family, the structure of her family can just be dismantled.
Well, so is mine. I didn't say F. Clarence Thomas.
But you're also, I mean,
I'm just me. I'm not the mayor.
You're not the mayor.
I have no power, control, or influence on people. Okay, I got it, Brandon. Thanks.
It just seemed like people were more upset about her comments and her being using the F word than the actual destruction of civil rights here. And that really should be the patch of fire.
Yes, and of course, in her defense, this is if ever a moment called for profanity, this is one that did. Some of the other times where she has kind of flown off the handle on this business where she's talking about the size of her male appendage dealing with the Italian Americans, I mean, those seemed like ridiculous overreactions.
Yeah.
I think this one was not, I mean, the whether or not the profanity was advised, her anger was certainly well-placed and understandable.
Well,
and,
then maybe she shouldn't be like that the rest of the time, because then when she wants to make an impact with something like this, it doesn't land. It just tracks with, that's Lori being Lori, right? And it doesn't do anything. Brandon, you did offer me the nice transition, and thank you for seeing where I was going with your upsetness about Democrats, and maybe not yours, but also a lot of people you know, and interact with them. We see it on Twitter, upset Democrats, progressives who say, well, I voted in 2020. I helped get you a president, a Senate, and a House that's blue. And this still happened. I'm not voting again, which to me is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
I agree with you. Like you and me, we talked about, we're in complete agreement. The importance of voting matters. I just think that the strategy from National Democrats of blindly just saying, oh, you want to fix this vote or chip in $6 to this campaign, that does nothing to inspire hope or confidence. Because people, they did that and they want to see results. They want to see action. They want to see a plan. They want to see some outrage. They want to see you at least try, even if there's nothing you can really do because of the Hyde Amendment. They at least want to see you do something. And just like Kamala Harris did on TV saying, well, we have an election coming up in November. That's not going to get it done.
Do you think
that's not going to get people out to the polls?
So you're arguing, and I think it's a very valid point, that the immediate reaction of, well, just vote, is just missing the moment. And
completely.
That if you do some action implicitly, people will vote based on what you do. You don't have to just say, well, just vote.
Voting isn't a comprehensive strategy for any party. You got to play the long game. You got to do some organizing. You got to inspire people. You got to energize people. The right, the GOP, they're energized. They're inspired. They've been energized and inspired for years now. You can't just finger wave and say, oh, can't do this, can't do that, can't do that, can't. But hey, chip in $6 to my campaign, vote in November, and maybe get the same results of nothing happening. You have to inspire. You have to lay out what you're going to do. And you have to show, hey, here's what we can do. Here's what we can't do. Here's what we want to do can't work. You have to lay those things out. And that comes down to messaging as well. Right now, they have not met the moment at all. The draft opinion leaked May 4th, May 3rd, right? We're about to go on July 4th weekend. 2 months. What's happened? You knew this was coming. So what are you doing?
But realistically, what can they do? They have control of the U.S. Senate, but with the good graces of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and some real conservative Democrats who are not going to go along with a lot of the things that they might need to go along with to make some real changes. The filibuster is still in place. That's on the Democrats, I guess, but they can't even get the filibuster modified because of Manchin and Sinema. So realistically, they could put things up for votes and have these symbolic votes where the House will pass something and the Senate won't act on it. And does that make them look more or less feckless? I don't know. It does. I mean, the message does have to be that the Democrats are going to have to hang on to the House, and it doesn't look like they're going to. They're going to have to get more than 50 votes in the Senate if they're going to make any meaningful changes. And so the only way to do that is by voting. I don't know. What are you suggesting they should be doing?
But you got to do more than just say vote. Like, so you got to tell me what they're voting for. You got to say, we need this many seats to do this. If you want this, this needs to happen. Just saying vote doesn't give anyone inspiration or confidence. They need to see the long game here. And right now, there is no long game. The other side's got a long game, and they basically have reached the finish line here. They got the touchdown. Where is the vision and the plan from the other side?
I would say if this were the finish line, that would be a relief, but I don't think this is at all the finish line.
Well, sadly, you're right.
He
just said the goal line. They're going to try and score other touchdowns, is what I think.
Of course.
the difference in messaging was really stark. I think one example you saw, there was a young woman on getting interviewed, I think, on MSNBC saying, I'm basically, my civil rights are completely under attack, and I just got a text from the Biden campaign asking for $15 for the Democrat, if I could pitch in $15 for the Democratic Party, right? That's not the message that I want to hear. You contrast that with someone like an AOC who's coming out with really more of a civil disobedience, grassroots organizing approach, where it's basically saying, we're not going to obey these laws in these states. Here's ways that you can help that aren't political, that are more on the grassroots organizing side. And I think that does get, to Brandon's point, more at movement building, addressing the problem directly that they see, and building trust with voters that they actually care about this issue, and beyond, simply its political calculus in November.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw Tony Evers, I don't know if this is updated since, but say that he would not, or he would offer clemency to any doctor that was prosecuted for having given an abortion in Wisconsin. I mean, Joe Biden could say that, but he's not only the leader of the Democratic Party, he's the president of the United States, and there's precedents that sets, and it's got to be, I do at least sympathize that as president, it's a different role than just the party leader. Like, you have to worry about the long game of the Republic too, right?
Yeah, but this is a historically unpopular decision. That's the other thing. Like, the majority of Americans.
I get it, but I mean, you have to worry about what you do in office, that the next man or woman could then go off of that and do something else that's similar and use your example as the precedence to justify what they're doing.
I just want to offer a slight correction. Joe Biden could not offer clemency or commutation or pardons to
anybody. Not a federal
crime.
Under
state law.
Sorry, so. Thank you. And I really appreciate that you took it instead of Heather, so she didn't have to be the one to correct me. So she's I mean because Heather's
wonderful.
No, Heather's wonderful, and I feel like she always has to do it, and then we make fun of her, and then it's like, so no, you are absolutely right. We'll edit that part out just because, when I'm on, we make sure we edit all of my mistakes. I see where everybody's coming from on the energizing thing. I just at the end of the day feel like, well, Republicans have pushed for this for 50 years, right? These are long game things, and we are such a gratification now society that, maybe my way of just like, well, obviously voting is going to make the difference. Just isn't the way of messaging of the future, right? Maybe that's not the way to connect with people who are in the news cycle 22 out of 24 hours.
Because there's people that voted. Like, there's millions of people that voted who feel like, okay, I did it. I do it every year. I do it all the time. What's happening? What's the plan here? Like, there's a feeling of hopelessness going on right now. People are hanging their heads. You gotta do something. You gotta at least give a speech. Why is there no primetime fireside chat going on from the president?
Well, he's at the G7
State of the Century.
Right. I guess they do have, if we can talk over
Zoom.
I know, you're right.
Come on, man.
I did see some interesting polling that in about 4 or 5 months ago, the Republican general ballot ticket was up about 3 points. That same poll recently showed Democrats up 6. I don't think that's where we're at. I think if you took a poll of polls, it would be a little bit more even. But I don't know. I think that everyone counts, or there's a lot of pundits out there who say, well, with guns, with abortion and January 6th, Democrats have these things to run on. They should be able to stymie a big red wave. But I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see.
But inflation is
going right.
Unless that turns around in some dramatic fashion, inflation is just going to dominate this election, I think. And so people are going to say, well, yeah, guns, abortion, but you know, $6 a gallon gas.
Right, exactly. I wanted to talk. I saw the story about Chicago's Thompson Center, Google in talks to buy it and save it. I feel like half the time I come on the Mincing Rascals, we end up talking about the Thompson Center. So I was excited to see some news about it today. Eric, you excited? I forget who's pro Thompson Center or not.
Is anyone vehemently anti? I kind of am.
I like it. I think it looks cool. But if it's literally costing us millions and millions of dollars and it's leaking and it's not modern, it's a building that looks kind of strange on the outside. I'm sorry.
Well, I agree with you.
The state sold it. It's not on the tax. It's not owned by the state anymore.
Okay.
Governor Pritzker sold it to a development firm, and the development firm has promised to renovate it and create, correct all of the leakiness of it. And they got a big discount on the price for it. And so this would be Google coming in and sort of buying it from that redevelopment firm, which was always sort of the best case scenario under this plan. Right. And there, I believe, is still a portion of the Thompson Center that would be is reserved for state offices or for public use. You know, the issue was always that, you know, to sort of maximize the value of that land, the whole structure had to be taken down. But if you take down that structure, you're putting the Clark and Lake subway stop and the, you know, sort of the entire structure of the L right there sort of at risk. So that's why this happened. It's just wild to me to think if this happens, that this sort of albatross, you know, that had been in downtown Chicago, which I personally love. I know I do not often express a direct opinion on this show, but I love the Thompson Center. And, you know, to sort of see it sort of be of interest to a 21st century company like Google, I think is breaking a lot of people's brains right now. Because, you know, on Twitter, if you say Thompson Center, the chances are somebody's going to say, is it going to get turned into a water park? And, you know, the fact that Google looks at this building and says, hey, yeah, we can do something with it, would really be is amazing, A, and it would be a huge vote of confidence for the downtown office market, which is still sort of troubling post, you know, which is struggling post pandemic, you know, during the, you know, remote work revolution and everything. So if it comes to fruition, expect to see Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker decked out in Google clothes and waving Google flags. And does Google have a theme song singing the Google theme song?
We can make one.
The current Google headquarters is over in the Fulton Market area, right? And how big is that? How many employees do they have there? How much floor space do
they have? They have 2,000 employees.
Whoa, Brandon. I was like, man, Eric's throwing out a very specific question. Now we're going to have to put a pause, and Brandon had it. Nice job, Pope.
I was writing a story on it today. But 2,000. But you'd imagine, though, that if Google does move into the Thompson Center location, they're going to recruit more. That's going to be a central Google hub. And I can only imagine what they would do with that space. If you look at the Silicon Valley Google areas, you know, they got self-driving cars. They've got all kinds of different fancy gadgets and things. Like Heather said, this would be a big boom for the downtown market. I mean, right across from City Hall as well. I think it'd be a bigger get than a water park would be, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm just so pro Art Deco that anything.
I like the Thompson Center too. It's nice.
Okay.
All right. I never had a beef with it, you know? Got good restaurants inside.
Right. It just got pretty shabby there toward the end, right? I mean, you go in there, the carpets are peeling up.
So did the Tribune Tower, and that's why I'm broadcasting really? From where I am. And you could buy a Tribune condo if you want. All right. Anyone watching anything cool? Anything out there to recommend? I'm so excited. Only Murders in the Building is back with season 2. Anyone else looking forward to anything out there?
So I just finished the new reboot season of Borgen, which is the Danish political drama. And I understand that this is super on brand for me.
I'm glad you said it. I was like, you have got to be bleeping me that Heather Cerrone's in love with a Danish political, because you just couldn't get into politics in your everyday life.
I can't. This is the problem with my life. For money, I write about politics. For fun, I read about politics and watch about politics. So yes, but it's really fantastic. And so now there are 4 seasons. All 4 seasons are worth your time. This final season is really fantastic. I love it with my whole nerdy being. So,
Zorn, you watching anything?
Well, I am listening to something and I'm really highly recommending. It's a competing podcast, actually. It's called Mother Country Radicals, and it is hosted by and narrated by Zay Dorn, who is Bernardine Dorn and Bill Ayers' son. And he tells the story of Bernardine and Bill in the 70s, and they were the weathermen and the weather underground. And it has some very candid interviews with his parents. It's a limited series, limited podcast series, but Mother Country Radicals, search for it on your podcast app.
Oh, cool. Pope?
I just finished Obi-Wan Kenobi. If you're a Star Wars fan, yes. Wow, what a journey. What a journey that was. And then on the other end, what Marvel's doing on Disney Plus with Ms. Marvel, it's a Pakistani superhero. And the way it embraces Pakistani culture, like I feel like I'm learning something new every episode about a culture I didn't know much about. And the latest episode, actually, they go to Pakistan. And the way they film it, the way they highlight the culture there, it's just so different, so vibrant, and so beautiful. And it also intersects a lot of history I didn't know about with the Indian Hindi conflict with the Pakistanis, this thing called the partition that the British did that was a devastating, had a devastating impact on the culture and still has so much trauma on people from the Pakistani culture today. So Ms. Marvel on Disney Plus, really good educational piece. Obviously, it's Marvel. It's superheroes, so that part's there. But I think if you're just curious about learning something new, it's a really good watch for that.
Mr. Berg?
The last two things I watched were terrible. I watched the new Father of the Bride reboot with Andy Garcia and Gloria Estefan. It was not good. It started great. Started really good, in fact.
Zero to 100. How many minutes was it good for?
It was good for the first 20 minutes. Like some great Miami shots. Like pretty funny. Like pretty well written. So that was like really bad. I wouldn't want to recommend it. I did just finish a novel called Butcher's Crossing. It was written in the 60s by this novelist, John Williams. He's maybe my favorite novelist. So if you're in the market for a novel about a buffalo hunt in the 1870s, read Butcher's Crossing.
It's funny. Really I was good. Just thinking that. So that's great. Speaking of John Williams, our fearless leader will be back next week. As many of you know, when I host, we get this thing done tidy in under an hour. That's how we do it on the Mincing Rascals with me filling in. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Heather, Eric, Austin, Brandon, so good to chat with you all. We will drop another pod on you next week. And of course, you can catch a version, little snippets of the Mincing Rascals Saturday night on WGN Radio. Till next time, bye. I don't know how this ends, so yeah. Later. Bye.
We sing the Google song. Oh,
Google.
We're going to get sued. They're going to sue us.
G-O-O-G-L-E.
Bye, everyone.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.